Hello, and welcome to the History of England, supplementary episode 31A, Anglo-Saxon Questions, Conversion, Church, Economy and Stuff. There have been a few very interesting questions over the last few weeks, which I've not really had time to dig into, but having had a bit of time off has allowed me to spend a bit more time on the whole thing, which has been fun, because as usual, the questions were really interesting. So although I did say on my last episode that it would be next week before the next episode, here's an extra supplementary one for you. The following questions relate to paganism, to the Norman Church and to the Anglo-Saxon economy, so if these don't interest you very much, you can tune out now if you wish. So let me do it by theme, if that's okay. So first of all, the first part of some questions from Chris Thomas. Chris also says nice things about the podcast, and modesty forbids me to repeat them, but thank you very much for your kind comments, Chris. Okay, so Chris says, the Anglo-Saxon period saw a massive shift from pagan to Christianity, and this must have been a huge change to the way people lived. Or maybe it didn't. Maybe life just went on. You might actually notice that this isn't really a question, but I decided I'd assume it was. Because actually, the more you think about it, the more interesting a question you realise it is. Things almost certainly didn't change overnight. There are many things that get borrowed from what went before or get adapted by Christianity. And of course, all the books and things focus very much on the process of the change. Augustine, St. Cuthbert, and all that sort of thing. This is a different question. How much did it really change daily life? So thanks for the question. And again, I should reference the help of the people on Historum Forum for their help in answering this one. Let me start with a very quick survey of the Anglo-Saxon gods. Their pantheon of gods is very similar and shares the same root as the Norse gods. The danger is, though, that we use the same much later sources for our information, and it's really not the same thing. But we do know some of the gods. There's Woden, a maker of great things and a wanderer in disguise. He's the god to whom the Wessex royal family traced their lineage. And of course, he gave his name to Wednesday. There's Thunor, the thunder god who gave his name to Thursday. And Chu, the god of war, who gave his name to Tuesday. The fertility goddess Frigg gave her name to our Friday. But the question was, how much daily life changed? Now, of course, there's the obvious one, that there was no longer a pantheon of different gods, but just one god. The Anglo-Saxons also believed in a number of supernatural beings, such as wights, elves, and household gods called Cofgodas. And the church tried very hard to stamp out the belief in these beings, and that of witches. But such evidence as there is points to a view that the belief in gods and spirits that lived in the earth and animals and plants died very slowly. For example, here's a ploughman's prayer to the earth goddess from later in Anglo-Saxon England, when he cut the first furrow of the year. Earth, 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 O earth, our mother, may the all-wielder ever Lord grant thee, acres are waxing, upward are growing, pregnant with corn and plenteous in strength. And most other things tend to stress continuity rather than change. So, for example, the church was eager to get rid of the symbols of paganism as quickly as possible, but Pope Gregory appreciated the issues around this, and he gave the following famous instruction. I have come to the conclusion that the temples of the idols in England should not on any account be destroyed. Augustine must smash the idols, but the temples themselves should be sprinkled with holy waters, an altar set up in them, in which relics are to be enclosed. For we ought to take advantage of well-built temples by purifying them from devil worship and dedicating them to the service of the true God. So the church itself realised the importance of fitting in with the existing traditions and places. Churches would often be built on the sites of pagan temples, and on some occasions the Christian and pagan shrines would be built side by side. There may also have been less difference in the place of worship than you might think. The network of local parish churches we're used to today is very much something that starts in later Anglo-Saxon times. There would have been a simple altar originally, with a new network of monasteries providing the centre of Christian orthodoxy, leadership and source of preachers. The church also adopted feast days and converted them to Christian feast days. So, for example, Easter, the goddess of dawn, had her feast day at the same time of year as Christian Easter. Hence the use of the pagan name for the most important of the Christian celebrations. And there's our Christmas, the 25th, which corresponded to Mondrianit, the winter solstice. Marriage is one thing that looks very different in the 12th century to the pagan approach. But then we need to remember that it's not until the 12th century that the church gets round to really regulating marriage and stipulating that a priest needs to be present. And in 1075, Lanfranc introduces a decree that any marriage has to have a priest present. So we can guess that in Anglo-Saxon England, that hadn't actually been the case. I don't think it likely that the pagan practice of a purely civil marriage and a relatively easy divorce, I'd think it likely that the pagan practice of a purely civil marriage and a relatively easy divorce sticks around for some time after the conversion. One thing that does change, of course, is tolerance. It's notable that the Anglo-Saxon kings allow the missionaries into their lands and usually take an approach of letting their people choose. So Penda, for example, was a convinced militant pagan with no desire to convert. But even he allowed preachers to go and talk to his people, and his own children were allowed to choose freely. Once the church had a firm hold, that was that. Only one possible religion, and indeed they spent a lot of time and effort stamping out even the Celtic Christian practices. Nothing I've read suggests that we know very much about any kind of pagan priesthood as far as the Anglo-Saxons are concerned, but if there was a priesthood, maybe it had some similarities to the role of the Druids in pagan British society. The Druids fulfilled a lot of the role that the church fulfilled in the Middle Ages, is the point, in terms of a central cultural role and in education. So it may be that there's another thread of continuity there. The same role is taken on by a new organisation. So the long and short is probably very little change straight away in real practical terms after conversions. There would have been physical changes in the type of ceremonies, for example the replacement of blood sacrifices, and in the place of worship, and the end of officially having multiple gods, but you can bet that for a long while paganism was simply driven underground. One other theory worth noting is the idea that there would be a very large British Christian population already part and parcel of the new Anglo-Saxon kingdoms anyway. So, the so-called conversion may not have been as big a change as we think. There's a healthy debate about the scale of the migration into England of the Anglo-Saxons, and archaeologists in particular raise the question of whether the Anglo-Saxon invasions are rather more like the Norman conquest, with a layer of aristocracy laid over a mainly British population. I'd personally stick to the tradition of a large-scale migration, but I think it is inevitable that there was a significant surviving British population with a Christian tradition, and this must have helped ease that transition. Matt also asked a question about the church at the time of the Norman conquest. He asked, "I was wondering if you'd be willing and interested in going into the religious and ecclesiastical differences between Normandy and the Anglo-Saxon England, and what it meant for England post-1066. Yes, I would be willing and I would be interested, and I also came to this question with a prejudice, which was that the Normans thought the English were a bunch of provincial no-hopers and it was a darn good job they'd arrived so they could pull the English church out of the Dark Ages into the Dark Ages. But you know what I mean. The more modern Dark Ages. And actually, I do think there's a large element of that, but it does need a bit of modification, I think I've found. The first thing to remember is William's attitude in 1066. Despite his brutal subjection of the Anglo-Scandinavian lay and ecclesiastical aristocracy by 1086, he started off with the traditional view that he'd just fit into the role that Edward the Confessor had before, and he'd just be a regular English king sort of guy. He was also clever in selecting the bits he liked about his new kingdom and holding on to it, rather than just changing it all for the sake of it. So there's all that political stuff about retaining the administrative and judicial structure of the Anglo-Saxon state, but there's also the church stuff. The peace of God is an interesting example. This is the Pope trying to put a brake on, in the words of Monty Python, the violence inherent in the system. William has to introduce this to Normandy, but he has no truck with introducing it into England. William inherited a country which was very insular in thought and custom, which was more part of the Scandinavian world than the Western European tradition. Oddly enough, though, part of this tradition was an extreme reverence for the papacy, an almost guileless veneration. Maybe because they were so far away, they couldn't see the papacy with all its warts and venalities. But William changes that, of course, and you see much more conflict after 1066, as the Norman kings try to maintain their independence from the papacy, but also bring England into the European mainstream. Having said that, of course, it's also partly because their takeover coincides with a full flush of reform movement from the papacy, which led to the investiture crisis. And let's be clear also, accepting any kind of reduction in his authority, William was a pious son of the church, and he was really keen to make sure his church in England reflected the best practice in terms, for example, of chastity of priests and the architecture of their cathedrals. So there were quite a few things that led me to modify my view that the Normans were a bunch of arrogant SOBs who walked over the English way with hobnailed, open-toed sandals. And in box one, here are things that stress continuity rather than change. Okay, so William made it clear to his lot that they would have to respect the adherence to English customs. So any Norman bishop or abbot had to take legal advice from his English monks or priests when they introduced changes. Secondly, there was clearly genuine veneration for King Edward the Confessor. It's a bit odd because nowadays we think of Edward as a real loser, but then he was genuinely venerated. And of course, he'd also spent a lot of his life in Normandy, so was well known there. And thirdly, we see lots of examples where the Normans and English do work closely together. One example is the Norman knight Reinfrid and the English monk Eldwin, who revived monasticism in the north, including historic sites such as Jarrow. Fourthly, we have to remember that most of the daily life of monks and priests would have gone on as much as before. Monks in particular were regulated by the rules of their order. And finally, it's worth noting that the Normans don't make any great increase in the number of monasteries, just a couple I think, though they do donate a lot of English land to their Norman monasteries. Then in box two, there are a number of changes the Normans do make, which had happened before, and therefore may have not looked like such a big change. The biggest example is their attempt to resolve the practice of clerical marriage, which is something that Dunstan and Edgar had already had a hack at 100 years before. But immediately 1066, of course, it still did probably feel to the English like a bunch of new guys cracking the whip. Secondly, in this particular box, there's the wholesale moving of English sees to new location. So Lichfield, Selsey, Dorchester and Sherborne are moved to Chester, Chichester, Lincoln and Salisbury. You might argue that this again is something that had also happened in Anglo-Saxon England, but it is far more systematic under the Normans. So maybe we can put it in the continuity box, but it's a bit of a stretch. Basically, the Normans made the rural cathedral a thing of the past. Okay, so there you are, in those two boxes, there are some arguments for continuity rather than it being a big change. But I think there were a number of changes, and they must have hit the English really hard. The first is the ecclesiastical leaders, abbots and bishops, who are very quickly replaced by Normans. That includes the guy at the top. Stigand was fired, and Lanfranc was hired. There are a few survivors, like Wulfstan, but they are very much the exception. Those new guys definitely have a view of Norman superiority, and when they get it wrong there is fierce resentment, such as the abbot who changes the Gregorian chant to the monks at Glastonbury and has to send in the soldiers to keep order. Another change is the separation of church and secular law. In Anglo-Saxon England, all law is delivered through the 100 courts. After 1075, all members of the church are tried in separate law courts, something which will lead to much trouble and debate for Henry II and Thomas à Becket. And then there's the architecture thing. Norman architecture was different to English, much less angular, but the big thing was the scale and the use of stone. It took a while, but as I think I said in the relevant episode, just think about having Durham Cathedral dumped on your doorstep instead of your nice, small, thatched Anglo-Saxon church. That's a very solid and visible sign that there's a new regime in town. So in the summary, in many ways, the religious situation around the conquest mirrored the secular one. The continuity was infinitely greater than the changes, but the leadership completely changed, and there was a new agenda energetically pursued by people convinced of their superiority. So I'd bet to the English that it felt like a pretty major change. Then we've got some non-church questions about war and taxation from Chris again. Here's the first one. I'm also fascinated by the two main Viking wars. Where did all the English troops come from? Surely after 2 or 3 years of fighting, all the able-bodied men would be dead. I do think the two wars are really quite different, so let's look at them each separately. It does seem absolutely amazing that Alfred is able to go back again and again to call out the Third, especially in those critical years of 870 to 871 where warfare is constant. I think one answer is in the size of the armies. The Anglo-Saxon word for army, which I'm sure I'm just about to butcher, was here, as in Hereford, for example, the ford the army used to cross into and attack the Welsh. According to a law of King Ina of Wessex, in the late 7th century, the word can refer to any group of armed men above 35. Then there have been all kinds of estimates about how many fighting men you could get into a Viking longship, but generally I've gone for an average of 50 per ship. So this means that the original 6th century invaders were in war bands of, let's say, 250-odd, and the Viking armies of the 9th and 10th centuries reach a maximum of about 12,000. So the armies themselves are not that massive. In the 9th century wars with Alfred, the armies were dominated by the traditional third. No doubt there would have been a core of household royal troops, but the Húscarls don't really become a major element until the 10th century wars. So the point is that Alfred can call on pretty much the whole male population for his army. So how many men could he draw on? Well, the population of Wessex was in the order of 450,000 in 1086, and let's assume it's similar in the late 9th century. Let's assume that the able-bodied male population of fighting age comes to about 30% of the total, and we have a total fighting strength of 135,000 men in Wessex. We also know that the Anglo-Saxon kingdom was prepared to commit a stunningly high percentage of its men to war. The garrisons of Alfred's boroughs, when all added up, come to 27,000, which is 6% of the total population. This sounds really high, especially when you compare it to the Napoleonic Wars, for example, where at its height only 4% of Prussia's total population was committed to war. But things are so different in Alfred's day. Every man was capable of fighting, weaponry was relatively simple. Plus those garrison duties would have been rotated and expected to fit into a churl's day and year. It wasn't expected to be a full-time professional army manning the wall every day. So if we do the maths for 870 to 871, the full male population is capable of fighting, and you are prepared and able to commit 6% of your population to the fight. You have a pool of 135,000 men. In each battle, you could lose at most 1 to 2,000 men. So Alfred could lose a lot of battles before his resources were exhausted. By the time of the late Anglo-Saxon state, the world had changed again. Now you need a professional soldiery with a load of kit that takes 5 hides to support. Hence, the development of a professional standing army, the Húscarls. The king's Húscarls probably numbered 3,000, and the leading thanes would each have had many hundreds more. With the same maths, you would come up with the same answer in late Anglo-Saxon times as early, i.e. Ethelred had plenty of resources to call on in terms of the number of men. He's now king of all England, actually, and if the total population of England was as low as 1.25 million, then the total available fighting strength was about 400,000. But now, of course, the resource is that much more inflexible. You have to arm and train a professional warrior. And actually, I think the indications are that in the early 11th century, and in 1066, the Anglo-Saxon kingdom's resources of professionals are direly stretched, especially in 1066. In fact, 1066 is a good example of all this. After the defeat at Fulford and the expensive victory at Stamford Bridge, we know that Edwin and Morcar are raising a new army, but they need more time to do so. Presumably, because they're now having to train and arm a professional army, rather than just call out the third. So, a bit of a long-winded answer, sorry about that. The short answer is I don't think it's a question of there not being the able-bodied men available, but of the increasing need to have trained soldiers. Chris then says, and the gold. How did the Vikings extort so much gold year after year? Were the coffers empty after one ransom? If so, how were they replenished so quickly? And if not, why was this gold not put to better use? And economics, how did the economy work back then? What were the imports and exports, and how did the king collect his taxes? Surely all the gold must have come from exports. And duty on imports? So I guess this question is all about how Ethelred manages to pay the Dane gold so much, and where all the gold and silver comes from to make the coins that he uses. The amount of money that Ethelred raises to pay Danegeld is truly astonishing. From £10,000 in the first one to a massive £48,000 near the finish. Put this in context, we know that Henry I still levies Danegeld in 1130, and he raised from that Danegeld £2,400, which gives you an idea of the scale of those massive Danegeld tributes. It's rather ironic that some modern historians, desperate to rehabilitate Ethelred, give him some credit for the efficient way he managed to give away all our money. Yay! Well done, Ethelred, for being so efficient at losing. We know frustratingly little about how the enormous sums were raised, though. Taxation would have been one part of it, and Anglo-Saxon England was outstandingly well organised by comparison with the other states of Western Europe. The geld was a land tax, essentially. Just to remind you, Anglo-Saxon England was divided into basic units of land called hides, which were grouped together into hundreds, each of which had a court which was held regularly. The hundreds were then grouped together into shires, and each shire had its own reeve, a royal officer who collected the tax and administered justice. So a geld was quite easily collected. The rate of the levy per hide was decided by the king, and the shire reeve would communicate this through the hundred courts, or directly to each village. Obviously, it's not quite as simple as this. There were exceptions and privileges. The king could vary the rate for each hide to make allowance for local conditions. And there are different systems and nomenclature in some parts of the country, but this is the basic model, and it's pretty efficient. There's the lovely reference, for example, to the fact that Svein Forkbeard's only act as the King of England was to raise a tax. He died before the collection could be completed, and so the tax was then given back to those who'd paid it, which is, again, pretty efficient. It's likely that the Danegeld raised a little bit more in the 11th century than in the 12th. We know that the standing fleet of 16 ships, for example, cost between £3,000 and £4,000, and it looks as though this was what the standard levy of the geld would have been expected to deliver every year. So as you can see, there's a massive gap between the Danegelds and the normal tax levy. So those big tributes were not paid out of the treasury as a normal part of administration, but were part of a massive national effort, about which, again, we know very little. But we can have a go at thinking how they actually went about getting all this money together, and we can make some educated guesses. So let's do a summary of where an Anglo-Saxon king's revenue come from. That sounds fun. Number one was rents and sale of produce from his own domain land, and this was probably the biggest single item. Number two would have been taxes on his ports. Edward the Elder had decreed that all trade needed to be done through a port, which is not necessarily a coastal thing, by the way, it could simply be the local town. He did that so that the king's reeves could levy a tax on activity, internal trade, imports, exports. For exceptional circumstances, then we'd have number three, which is gifts. The king would go to an individual and ask them very nicely to make a contribution, please. If they said no, he would let them know that please was only there in his sentence for show, and that the individual could make a contribution or find himself at the end of a rope or on the benches of some slave ship somewhere. Gifts were probably the main way that the Danegelds were paid, and it's organisations like the church that would have been the main givers, to the extent of even melting down silver and gold religious articles. Ethelred would also have levied special gifts on the towns, notably London. And finally, he could sell off the family silver, or the family land. So we do have a record, for example, of a charter where Ethelred sells one of his manors, and specifically says that he's doing this to pay the tribute. Basically, Ethelred sells off the family silver in another sense. England over the preceding 100 years had built up enormous wealth. Ethelred uses that to pay off the Danes, and when the local chirps have been stripped and the family trophy cupboard is looking a bit bare, the indications are that Ethelred is deserted by his thanes. Chris also then asked why these taxes were not put to better use. Now that is the $64,000 question. I have a feeling that there are a few thanes about asking Ethelred exactly the same question at the time. Back to those revisionist historians doing their best to show that he wasn't a complete dunderhead, that he was an efficient administrator, blah blah blah, but basically he wasted all that resource through rubbish leadership. The examples of both Alfred and Ethelred's son Edmund Ironside show what could have been achieved with all that money. And finally, was one last question about the economy and where all the gold came from. So how did all that work? We did do something on the Anglo-Saxon economy in a previous episode, so just to summarise. We don't know that much about it, but we get little glimpses here and there and can guess. So it looks pretty clear that wool, even in those days, was our major export. And this may also have extended to woolen clothing. There's reference to cloaks in a letter in 796 between Offa and Charlemagne. We also know that English traders go far abroad. There's an English quarter in Rome, for example, and Cnut organises free passage in Italy for English traders with the papacy. So there's certainly import and export activity going on. And then we know that a series of ports, either coastal or linked to the coast by rivers, flourished in the period. Norwich, Ipswich, Colchester, Rochester, Dover, Southampton, and of course London. But I think one of the things Chris is asking is, where did all that metal come from, all that precious metal? With all that outflow of silver and gold to the Vikings, how come there was enough money in circulation to pay it? And how did it get replenished? Didn't it ruin the economy to have all that coin taken out of circulation? And certainly there are hundreds of English coins that have survived into modern times in Scandinavia that demonstrate how big those tributes were. England's coinage is remarkably high in consistent quality throughout the late Anglo-Saxon period, at about 92.5% silver. The 70 or so mints in England that produced the coins according to the royally issued dies hand-produced between about 5 and 10 million coins every 2 to 3 years. So how did that all happen with all this outflow of bullion? Well, one thing is that the tribute would have been partly paid for by gold and silver melted down, not just coin. So things like church ornaments and that sort of thing. Secondly, it's worth noting that only a part of day-to-day commerce went on using coins. An awful lot was still through a barter economy or payment in kind by services such as mowing a meadow or ploughing a field, that sort of thing. And thirdly, yes, gold and silver, Chris, would flow into the country from imports and exports exactly as you suggest. The implication of the ability to pay Danegeld was that England had a very healthy balance of trade indeed. And finally, England does herself have some silver mines of her own, in Derbyshire, Gloucestershire, Devon and the Mendip Hills in Somerset. But the indications are that most of the silver used in English coins came from the Harz Mountains in Germany. So trade must have been the most important element. Okay, well, thank you very much for those questions again, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope I've managed to answer the question adequately. Normal service will be resumed next week, and we'll talk about King Stephen and the 19-year-long winter we call the Anarchy. As I see you all next week.